Welcome to the South Carolina State Library's podcast, Library Voices SC. I'm Curtis Rogers, Communications Director, and today I'm pleased to have with us in our studio Dr. John Nelson. Dr. Nelson is the Chief Curator of the A.C. Moore Herbarium at the University of South Carolina. He received his Ph.D. in 1982 from Florida State University, and he also recently conducted an urban botany walking tour, and this is the second walking tour he's created for us, for our library patrons, and we're really happy to have him back on Library Voices SC. So welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you, Curtis. It's good to be here again.
Some of the things that came up when I was thinking about discussion topics is, since you had conducted an urban botany tour for us, what exactly is urban botany, maybe for listeners who might not have ever heard this term?
Well, that's a really good term, but I wonder if we could back up just a little bit.
Sure.
And talk about the definition of botany itself.
Okay.
And, of course, botany is the science of plants. And across the board, a very, very broad field. The aspect of botany that I'm interested in is called taxonomy, wherein taxonomists study the names of plants and also their classification. Mm-hmm. So that's what I do. And there are other kinds of botanists, though. Many will be studying the ecology of plants or their physiology or maybe their biochemistry or genetics. So it's a huge field. And for anybody that has any interest at all in plant life, they ought to consider themselves at least a nascent botanist.
Okay. One of the things that pops into my head is, what's the difference in horticulture and botany? Because, you know, you see the term horticulture a lot, but you tend to maybe think more of gardening.
And I'm not a horticulturist. In fact, I tell people I have a black thumb. But horticulture is an applied aspect of botany in which plants are remain alive and are grown for whatever reason, generally for ornamental value. But as I say, yes, you're right. Horticulture is the arena that gardeners get into, and what a fascinating area that is as an applied aspect of botany.
So if you have a black thumb and you want to, but you're really interested, then maybe working in an herbarium might be for you.
I guess we should say something about what an herbarium is.
Yes,
while we're at
exactly.
It. So sure enough, my interest in plants is not so much growing them, although I do have a garden in our backyard, but it's pretty much hit or miss. But I'm more expert at killing plants and turning them into long-term plant specimens. That is, specimens that are meant to last basically forever. In a scientific arena, this herbarium is actually an amalgamation of dried plant specimens.
When you talk about these kind of specimens, I know working in a library, we have to keep books at a certain temperature and you have to consider humidity. What other things do you have to worry about when you're curating these specimens?
You know, it's a real good question, and it does bring to mind the parallel between having a collection of basically anything. But certainly books are, in some ways, a lot like plant specimens. Everything obviously has to stay very dry, and at a proper humidity. All the materials that are used need to be acid-free, so that's a great concern. All sorts of different kinds of papers that are used for making these specimens have historically been bad choices just because they did have acid content. And the specimens fall apart after a while. And then there are things like keeping light out of the facility. We can't have our specimens exposed to too much light. And, of course, the two worst things would be bugs. And, of course, fire. Neither one of those will work.
Right.
So in some ways, there are some parallels between having a library of books and a collection of dried plant specimens.
And while we're talking about what an herbarium is, it's the A.C. Moore Herbarium. Who was A.C. Moore?
Andrew Charles Moore was a resident of Spartanburg County. He was the first chairperson of the biology department when it was invented in 1907.
Hmm.
And he was a botanist, and he was really a kind-hearted soul that apparently made a lot of friends. He was a good people person because they stuck him, I mean, they selected him to be the president of the university for 2 different years.
Oh.
And he remained a part of the biology program at that time and also had begun the beginnings of the herbarium that we now have over in Coker Life Sciences.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting that A.C. Moore's original collection is all at hand. We pulled it from the main collection so that it's easily available, and we need to work that up as a sort of a project so that people can come look at it too.
Definitely. And when you're talking about some of these early specimens, what are some of the oldest specimens that you have?
Oldest specimens that we have go back to the 1800s. Probably the very oldest one that we have is about 1817, we think.
Wow.
And it still shows color. It's really weird that the color has really lasted for so long in that specimen. But the oldest ones we've got by far are those that were a part of the Henry William Ravenel Herbarium, which is part of Converse College.
Oh.
It's now in our facility.
Okay.
And we're still working on that collection. But as far as the antiquity of these specimens, pre-Civil War, most of those.
Okay. And you mentioned the other herbarium. Are there other herbaria across the state?
There are. We are but one of about 8 active herbaria in South Carolina. And we actually have formed a consortium of herbaria so that we can mix it up and do things together. And it's great. It's great having sort of a local group at the state level,
mm-hmm.
in which we can cry on each other's shoulder or or applaud each other for good things that are being done in other herbaria.
Mm-hmm. And that actually brings into my mind another question about how a library works and how herbaria works, but do you have anything that kind of relates to how we do interlibrary loans? Do you exchange specimens or loan specimens?
Since I've been the curator, I've been very, very keen on getting our material out there so that other researchers will see it. And the way this works is generally if we do make a loan to a scientist that's at far away herbarium, or maybe not so far away, but if we ship it off very carefully wrapped up, we hope that very conscientious botanist that we're dealing with will attach annotations to each and every sheet, that is each specimen that we've loaned, and those annotations would actually corroborate or correct the identity of the plant on the label, the information on the label of that specimen.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a beautiful arrangement whenever we do make loans, in that we're getting something back after the researcher, whoever it is,
mm-hmm.
has also been able to pull information off of our specimens. And it makes me think that there's a little bit of a difference. I think if there are interlibrary loans, that is in the case that a well-stocked library such as yours is able to make loans to other people, you probably don't want them annotated.
Yeah, I think we pretty much have them cataloged already, you know. But no, I can see where that would be interesting and helpful, because some of the stuff, you know, there's going to be additional information about.
Right, and many times, even myself, when I've been collecting specimens, I'm not really sure what the heck this thing is, so I'll prepare a label that can go with the pressed specimen, and I won't have the name of the plant on it, because I figure that somebody down the road is going to be able to put the right name on it after I'm long, long gone.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it's still a valuable scientific object, even though it doesn't have my determination of the plant's name on it.
Okay. And back to our original conversation, urban botany.
Right.
Yeah.
Urban botany. Well, of course, urban means, I guess it's the opposite of something like rural or suburban or something. But to me, urban just refers to cities, a cityscape that has a lot of stuff in it, including a lot of plants. Now, there aren't too many differences between, say, urban botany and the botany of a rural place or a natural area, mm-hmm. because both can be extremely interesting and also quite diverse. And this is the reason that I thought it would be a good idea to have this kind of walk, to get that idea or that notion across to the guests, to see that there's tons and tons of botany out there. It doesn't matter where you go. Mm-hmm. That's one of the nice things about being a botanist. You don't have to go very far to see stuff.
Yeah. What were some of the kinds of interesting things you came across on this recent urban botany walking mm-hmm. tour?
Well, I remember it was a cool, pretty early spring day, and but it was warm enough that I was able to declare that winter was over.
Thank you. We appreciate that.
And with a couple of hiccups since then, I think I was right. But the walk, we started right outside on the sidewalk, and instantly we were thrown into a whirlwind of interesting plants. And the first ones we talked about, of course, were the beautiful ginkgos that you've got mm-hmm. right out here on the side of the building. And as we progressed farther towards USC's campus, there were just all sorts of stuff. There was also a very loud leaf blower on the other side of Bull Street.
It's always going to happen when you plan something.
There's always something out there. If it hadn't been a leaf blower and we had been in the woods, it would have probably been a crop duster or something.
Right.
But we wandered down the street and saw all sorts of trees and shrubs, ornamental plants by and large. But they offered really rich source of botanical information to discuss. For one thing, we had to talk about leaf arrangement, which most people don't pay any attention to. But mm-hmm. if you're going to be a botanist really carefully examining plants to figure out what they are, you have to know what leaf arrangement is. And I don't know that you want to talk about that, Curtis. Do you want to talk about?
Sure, I would be happy
to. Well, everybody can figure this out pretty easily, but leaf arrangement is just the way in which leaves are attached to a stem. So if you have one leaf at a time, you can just think of this in your mind's eye, that you'd have leaves alternating up and down the stem. So mm-hmm. we say that those leaves are alternate mm-hmm. if there's one at a time. If the leaves are two at a time, mm-hmm. that is, they're opposite each other on either side of the stem, and we say those leaves are opposite. It's mm-hmm. very clever. And then the other alternative, which isn't a very common one, is when you may have leaves that are three or more at a time at one place on the stem. There are not a whole lot of good examples. Maybe you know of one.
Well, I know I actually just happened to be looking at some pictures since it is spring and people are starting to think about if they have poison oak or poison ivy. I remember seeing some examples of some leaf arrangements there, but then I saw poison sumac.
Well, I don't want to be the professor here correcting you too much, but
please do.
Poison oak and poison sumac have alternate leaves.
Okay.
It's the magic here is that each leaf is what we call compound with three leaflets. Uh-huh. So you got to be careful. You can't be looking at the leaflets when you should be looking at the leaf itself.
Well, one thing I noticed with the poison oak is that it kind of looked like an oak leaf.
That's right, and that's why it's called poison oak, I think. Before we go too far afield, I got to say that one really good example of a plant with whorled leaves, that is more than three at a time, would be oleander. And that grows outside, too.
Mm-hmm. And isn't every part of that poisonous?
I would think that it's a plant that you shouldn't be fooling around with too much.
Yeah, so no oleander tea.
And no hot dog sticks made with or marshmallows.
That would be sticks. Something to stay away from. What other kinds of things did you see on this urban botany tour?
Well, you know, we're in the urban aspect of Columbia, and I like this the situation in which there's a lot of old stuff in Columbia. And sure enough, this neighborhood is a fairly old one. So we got to see some old-timey shrubs, including Pittosporum, and maybe you've heard of that.
No, what's that?
Well, it's a sort of an Asiatic shrub, and it's blooming right now outside the building. Gorgeous flowers and sort of creamy green leaves. I'll take you out to show it to you. But then we also saw a good many different kinds of viburnum. Have mm-hmm. you heard of viburnums? Mm-hmm. And some of those are starting to bloom now. They're very, very pretty plants. A lot of times used as shrubs. And, of course, we have a number of native species of viburnum, although a lot of the old-timey ones are imported from southeastern Asia. Mm. And then we got closer and closer to the horseshoe, and let's see, we saw... We started seeing things like Nandina. That's mm-hmm. sort of old-timey, the old-timey Nandinas.
My grandmother had those with the red berries.
Right, mm-hmm. right, and sometimes reddish foliage, which is actually a pretty nasty weed sometimes. And then we got over there towards the Osborne Building on campus, and we saw these gorgeous old-timey spireas. They're mm-hmm. a lot of fun. And we saw one of the only two slash pines that grow on our campus.
Never heard of a slash pine.
Oh, it's a big, tall thing. It's right next to Pendleton Street there. And then, lo and behold, we came across the state's largest example of sawtooth oak, mm-hmm. which grows right there in Gibbs Green. I don't know when this plant was planted there, but it's got to have a lot of history. It must be 70 or 80 years old.
Wow.
I would think. I mean, it's grown very quickly because it's such a nice place. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then after that, we wandered around. We went to look at the oak trees in front of or behind LeConte College, some magnificent white oaks and also swamp chestnut oak. Mm. And then one of my favorite oaks, I have one in my front yard, is called Spanish oak. And that's Quercus falcata. But this variety on campus is called cherry bark. Hmm. And oh my goodness, it is like, I think it's the city's largest example of that species.
Really?
And that grows behind Pettigrew.
Okay.
And then as we kind of wandered our way, you know, all the students were looking at us and wondering what we were doing, hoping to join in with us and learn some botany. We got over to the horseshoe, and we wandered in front of McKissick Museum. Mm-hmm. McKissick is a really interesting place to see people as well as plants. Mm-hmm. And some of the old live oaks that are in front of McKissick are there to look at. And two of my favorite plants in the world are two very old American elms. Mm. That are on the horseshoe. And I can't be sure that they were part of the original plantings back in the 19th century, but there they are.
Wow.
And they're opposite each other on opposing sides of the horseshoe. Very, very pretty plants. And they're in good health. A lot of people ask me how come the elm trees haven't succumbed to the Dutch elm disease, mm-hmm. and I get to tell them that, well, down south here, our American elms aren't really affected by that disease. Hmm. It's more of a pathogen of New England and okay. points farther north. And then we managed to get back to the, almost all the way back to the library. I dismissed everybody behind Osborne and that pretty garden that they've got behind mm-hmm. their building. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a lot of beautiful things. When I walk around campus, I try to pay attention to all of the plant life, and there are, especially when things like right now are in bloom, mm-hmm. you know, it's hard to keep walking. You have to stop and take pictures.
You know, we have quite a good mixture of things that have been there, trees and shrubs that were there when I was an undergraduate. That was even before you. And as well as new stuff. And I'd have to like give a shout out to the grounds people in the last several years have done a remarkable job of beautifying our campus, and they've really added a lot of very interesting botanical tidbits that I've been able to use in my lectures or when we're on a campus field trip with my students.
Okay, well, one thing I've noticed walking through campus, when you go through to the other side of the horseshoe, between the horseshoe and the Russell House and the library, it looks like a huge greenhouse is there, and so I'm assuming they use that to put plants out around campus.
Right, and Charlie Ryan, I think, has a lot to do with that greenhouse. It's right behind the president's home. And I've been in it once or twice. It's got some very pretty things in it, but I don't spend a lot of time with it, actually.
Right, because we're going back to the dead plants that.
Right. Yeah, it's the two-dimensional plants that really keep me the most interested. But as I was walking over here, I just, you know, it's just remarkable. As I was walking over here in the drizzle a few minutes ago, I came by the president's house, and you got to go over there and see it. It's this beautiful thing called flowering maple.
Flowering maple.
And it's not a maple at all. It's got this silly common name, flowering maple. It looks more like a hibiscus. It's the genus Abutilon. Maybe people have heard of Abutilon. Gorgeous thing with red and yellow flower parts, and they're dangling. They hang like little bells. Tremendous, beautiful stuff.
Yeah, I've noticed there's some Brugmansia when you're walking over behind the president's house that's really attractive when that's in bloom.
Right, and that, of course, that'll be in bloom this late summer, I think, and autumn.
How do you deal with, in the herbarium, larger specimens? Because when you think of something like a Brugmansia, you know, that's a pretty big pretty big bloom and a pretty big stalk to kind of deal with.
It all comes with the experience of making specimens, and I like a challenge. There's no reason that a given collection of a plant needs to be confined to a single herbarium sheet. And you'll recall that a single sheet is about 11 by 17 inches of this acid-free paper that the pressed plant will be attached to. But if the plant is too big for one sheet, it's not a problem at all to have multiple sheets to accommodate all of the parts of that specimen. So that's what I'd recommend. But there are different ways that you can fold the flower or the leaves or whatever just so they'll fit on. But the clever botanist will make sure that all the parts of the plant are available for study while it's attached to the sheet. Sometimes that means making sure that you got one leaf that's turned right side up and one leaf that's turned upside down.
Okay.
And if you only have one leaf, one way around that is to get some scissors and cut it in half and turn one half the other way.
Okay.
So it's sort of a practical blend of art and science, I think.
Definitely. It definitely is. I remember taking a few of our State Library staff members over for a little tour of the herbarium.
Oh, right.
And, yeah, definitely seeing those and also learning about the – don't you have to – do you have – was it an oven that you dry?
Right. We have – when a botanist goes out into the field or the woods or the marsh or the meadow or wherever.
Or the urban setting.
Or the urban setting, and you have a plant press to put plants in, or you need to bring the plants straight away back to the herbarium. What we do is put them into a nice dry plant press and squeeze it down real tight so that all the plant parts are being having a lot of pressure applied to both sides. And then it all goes into an oven that we've got. And the oven gets only to about 110 degrees. So it's not going to burn anything up. And we set the plant press on its side so that the warm air from the bottom, there's a heating element down at the bottom with a little fan, and the warm air will rise through those plant presses and exit from the top and then take the water with it. And so, right, we're using this oven all the time. It's sort of an antique. It works great, though. knock on wood.
Well, that's the important thing. And speaking of the herbarium, is it open to the general public, or do people need to make an appointment? Or
it is, we love to have visitors. The problem is we don't have any room, and we don't really have a dedicated public space within the herbarium, and we are confined to about 1,400 square feet. So most of that is occupied by the cabinets in which the specimens reside and the workspace that we have for the people. So there's not a whole lot of room to be mixing it up in there. Mm-hmm. But every now and then we'll have a, you know, guests can come by. But definitely let us know if you do have an interest, and we'll see what we can come up with.
And of course, if anyone is doing research, they, you know, can search your catalog and see if you have something.
Right. We do have an online catalog of the vascular plants, and it's quite well used. In fact, I use it every day, and then we notice that it gets a lot of hits from the rest of the world as well.
That's fascinating. What kinds of new and exciting specimens have your team curated recently?
Well, I'd like to tell you that you may have heard of this. We, not so long ago, started up an exchange program with the nice people at Ho Chi Minh City in Vietnam.
Really?
And the reason we did that was that we didn't have any representation of Southeastern Asian plant species in our collection. And we figured that, maybe the nice people in Vietnam don't have much of a representation of South Carolina stuff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, of course, South Vietnam is a lot bigger than South Carolina. But we've been able to supply them with a number of our characteristic plant species and vice versa. Most of the plant specimens that they've sent to us have come from Central Vietnam, and they're gorgeous.
Is that affiliated with a university, or is it the?
It's affiliated with what's called the Institute of Tropical Botany.
Oh, wow.
They do all sorts of research all over their country. But, you know, some other things that we've been dealing with as far as new specimens. We have a colleague, his name is Keith Bradley, and he has been in South Carolina now for several years, moved up here from Florida, and he is sort of taken us on as his center of operation. And Keith is one of these crackerjack field botanists that is bringing tons and tons of specimens to us. In fact, I was just talking to him this morning, and he was telling me that he had texted me that he had just fallen into a creek. This is over in Chesterfield County, uh-huh, in search of what they call Merlin grasses, which are...
They sound magical.
They are sort of magical, and their taxonomy is difficult, and they grow underwater.
Oh,
so apparently he had fallen in the water, and he heard something else coming after him, it sounded like, and he got out of the water and looks around, and here comes a fox out of the water. I texted him later. I said, you need to be careful. Sometimes you might run into a rabid fox.
Yeah.
But anyway, we're getting interesting things like Merlin grasses brought to us from Keith, and then we have other spies out there that bring us interesting specimens too.
Sure, sure. do you ever request that if people do find something interesting or unique to either send you a picture or maybe, you know, bring in a sample?
Of course, you have probably heard of the identification service that we provide, and it's a free public service provided through our department, but we're very happy to look at anything you might want to show us. If you have a question about the identity of a plant, it doesn't really matter what it is, give us a try, and it's, of course, free, and you could just... People can send me a picture or drop it by, mm-hmm, or mail it to me or whatever. In fact, just this morning, I got a picture of a native, for instance, of a native rhododendron from a man who lives in Aiken, and he sent me the pictures of it. And of course, his pictures were good enough that I could identify it right there as our spring blooming rhododendron canescens. But otherwise, people will frequently bring in an unusual weed they might have starting to grow in their garden or their pasture. Last fall, for instance, a man in Clover, South Carolina, got to me this very peculiar weed that was growing in his oat field. And it's the first time this plant has ever been seen in South Carolina.
Really?
So it ended up being kind of important. If people do have mystery plants out there, we'd be happy to look at them. Mm-hmm. And if it's not the first time it's ever been seen in the state, that's not a problem. We don't mind looking at the really common things, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, when you said that, that made me think, is something like that a result of climate change, or do we know how the unique weed got there?
It's not easy to say, and all we know right now is that weed is in the state, and it's probably never going to go away just because it produces so many seeds, and it seemed to be so happy where it was up there in York County. Hmm. So there are a lot of questions about the distribution of these new plants and whether or not climate change really has affected that, or could it be just some happenstance situation in which these crazy little seeds mm-hmm. got moved into a new place, mm-hmm. didn't really have anything to do with the climate.
Yeah.
But that happens also.
Yeah, interesting. So we've talked a lot about the herbarium and urban botany, and the herbarium really is a library, you know, of specimens. But what's maybe either your relationship or the herbarium's relationship with other kinds of libraries, either academic or public? Or
In some cases, well-developed herbaria are actually part of a library or a museum, mm-hmm. say, on a college campus. Mm-hmm. Now, we don't enjoy that situation right now, in that we are wholly contained within the Department of Biological Sciences. Mm-hmm. But I would be between you and me, Curtis. I'd be
between the two of us.
I'd be real interested in having our herbarium associated with the Thomas Cooper Library mm-hmm. on campus mm-hmm. or another appropriate library. Mm-hmm. In Columbia, of course, for starters. Mm-hmm. But we've been very interested in working with the nice people at Thomas Cooper Library. And we've actually been worked up some rather formal displays mm-hmm. that they've been kind enough to allow us to show our stuff. One of the things that we did during last summer, the eclipse, mm. there was a big display that they had in the manuscripts and rare books. Mm-hmm. And we had a little corner of the library dealing with plants that bloom in the night.
Oh.
And that sort of leads the students into this, the idea that there are nocturnal mm-hmm. flowering mm-hmm. plants as mm-hmm. well as the stuff that opens up in the daytime. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, that's interesting, because that's not something you normally think about. But when we're thinking about the eclipse and the, you know, 2.5 minutes of darkness that we mm-hmm. faced, all of those kind mm-hmm. of questions came to light. Sorry, I couldn't resist that. So in kind of wrapping up, what other kind of special projects maybe will you be working on with the herbarium or with any other groups?
Well, just last week, we had 8 undergraduate art students from our graphic arts come over and look at a whole bunch of different kinds of herbarium specimens and do original art.
Oh, wow.
At the same time. We put them in our little annex. And they were busy as bees with their little paints and charcoal. And it was so much fun to watch them use these scientific objects for something that is not at all scientific. but could be. I was interested in getting those kids to know about the very detailed artwork that a lot of botanical research demands.
Mm-hmm.
And then some other things that are going on. We're gonna try to be finishing up with the Ravenel collection, and it's being digitized now as we go through the specimens and repair them. So you've kind of figured that after 170 years, some of the specimens need a little bit of shoring up. But that's going to be very exciting once we're finally finished with that. And that we're looking at getting a publication out of it as well.
Okay, wonderful. Lots of interesting stuff. And we've got links to the A.C. Moore Herbarium and also to more information about Dr. Nelson on the podcast link. So thank you so much for being with us today.
Curtis, it's been a lot of fun. It's always good to get over here and see what you guys are doing.
Well, thank you. And thank you to our listeners. You can find Library Voices SC on Podbean, Stitcher, and TuneIn Radio, or add us on your favorite podcast app. Our podcast website address is librarycast.podbean.com. We love hearing from our listeners, so send us your comments and suggestions for future topics. Library Voices SC is the official podcast of the South Carolina State Library. Until next time, this is Curtis Rogers. Thanks for listening.